every morning I wake up, I have the same thought. It's been a long time since something special happened to me. And I'm so alone, but I'm blessed, really, because if something nice actually did happen to me, I wouldn't have anyone nice to share it with. So maybe when something good happens, it'll be when I have someone nice. And then it'll be double great. I mean, I don't say that every morning. It's just too long, so I just say, double great. You wanna say it with me?
Double great?
Yeah.
No.
That's cool.
Drop down afternoon, drift in afternoon. Afternoon spray. Drop on my.
All right, hello and welcome to another edition of McMillan Men. This is the podcast where we talk about the Amazon Prime show Patriot. My name's Luke Burbank, and right over there is my friend and fellow afternoon spray enthusiast, Andrew Walsh. Hello.
Hello. Would you say that I'm sort of the Timmons to your Saperstein, or the Saperstein to your Timmons?
Let's think about that for a minute.
I would be Saperstein.
I don't know about that. I think we both have qualities of both of them, of both John Tavner, a.k.a. Does Timmons have a first name?
Yeah.
John Timmons?
He does call him John, because later on in this episode, Rob says, you changed your last name. But it seems like he always goes by the name John, which I would do,
that's
too,
smart.
If I were undercover. Yeah, because let's face it, what we're learning is John cannot keep a lot of the details straight. So let's just go with John for every alias.
Yeah, there are moments in this episode where, were he using different fake names, it would have gotten really bad.
Because
he's got multiple storylines colliding, but everyone's calling him John, so it's at least sort of keeping the illusion going. This is episode 5. I don't even want to try to read the actual title. I'm just going to say A Sad Man in Costume, Andrew.
That's right. It's in French, right? I'll try it. Un
nice.
Monsieur triste en costume. I am, whether I'm a Saperstein or a Timmons, I tell you, I am the, out of the two of us, I am not the one who should have attempted that, but somebody had to, and I stepped
that
up.
That was a, you know what, though? That was a very Timmons move of you.
Yeah, it was. You're right. Yeah. That's one of the qualities I have of Timmons, is that
yes.
I will say French words I don't know how to pronounce, and I will strangle a guy.
And I have put out a lot of questionable Craigslist.
Yeah, yes, you have.
And that's the Saperstein in me.
And you've been trying to sell me a kayak that I just don't want.
Well, it's a good the ad said it's a good kayak. And why am I standing this way? And why am I blocking this one part of it? That's not anything for you to be concerned about.
Just move your hand.
All right, so this episode starts with the scene where John is killing the wrong person in the hotel room. This is a very minor thing, but on my notes I have, how did John end up in the rug? So I kind of, upon the first watching of this, which was like, I don't know, months ago for me, I didn't notice some of these little details, but it's like he shoots the wrong guy, and then he's being carried out in a rug. I guess that after he shot the wrong guy, what, the prince's police or whatever came and got him and wrapped him up in a rug and took him out of there?
That's my understanding. I don't think we get a good answer to that. I could be wrong. Drink every time I say I could be wrong. I don't think we get a good answer for that, though. I think that he we just are supposed to fill in the blanks. This is a mission that went wrong. He kills an innocent, and then somehow he pays for that by getting captured and being held in solitary.
Yeah, which is, of course, where bad stuff starts to happen on the subject of witch. And, of course, a lot of the people listening to this show, they know about TBTL, our other podcast. Maybe there are a few people that don't. We did something on that show a few – God, was it a year ago now? We did the show for 24 straight hours. But we would take breaks at the end of each hour, more or less, And in order to pad out the show, we played the song American Pie by Don McLean, which is used in this show as a manner of torture on John. I had the thought watching this last night, American Pie is one of the top five. No, that's not true. Let me put it this way. American Pie is one of the least torturous songs I could think of to listen to over and over again. Where do you think it ranks in terms of songs you would not want to hear for 2 months straight?
You think it's not torturous. You think it's actually...
Not torturous. I'm no fan of Don McLean. He seems actually like kind of a jerk, honestly. But I don't think that the song is, you know, anything profound. But I don't think it's the worst. I can think of 10 songs off the top of my head that are I would way less like to hear than that.
If I were going to torture you, I'd play an Ornette Coleman song just right outside the cage. Just like I like it, but it's a lot of squawky duck sounding horns that I think would get on your nerves. It's kind of atonal.
No. You don't understand. I recently, and this is not the podcast for this, but I recently got into a serious Alice Coltrane phase. Alice Coltrane, also known as Turi Yasang Tianada, that's her Sanskrit name. This is the most outside jazzy harp jazz music. It makes Ornette Coleman sound like she loves you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Ornette Coleman?
I am. You always use it as a reference of a thing I don't like, and I actually think I don't dislike it as much as you think I dislike it.
Back to the American Pie thing, I think it's actually an interesting joke that, and I'm not even 100% sure of this because I'm not in the folk world, but I think it's an interesting joke that they pick a song that is ostensibly a folk song, you know, American Pie, that would be in the folk pop genre, and John is well into the folk world. We already know that. We're going to hear more of it during this episode. He gets into debates
about... He spends a lot of time on neo-folk chat rooms,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
What's the name of the chat room he's in?
Neo-classic or neo-traditional. Neo-traditional music.
Yes.
And so I think it's a joke that maybe even most people wouldn't want to hear American Pie over and over and over again, but especially somebody who is a purist about folk music wouldn't want to hear this song because it's so kind of bubblegummy and corny. That's layers there.
Right. I just was thinking last night as I was watching it, and I was thinking, you know, first of all, at least the song is like 9 minutes long. Because the shorter the song, the more repetitive it is.
Yep, I thought that too, yeah.
If the song is 2 minutes long, you're going to hear it how many more times over the course of 2 months? And it has a nice, you know, again, I'm not going to defend the lyrics. I think they're kind of corny. But it has a kind of a nice, I don't know, a nice relaxing sort of vibe to it that I think, again, if they were to put on something by Pantera, that would be very challenging for me. If they were to put on something by Rob Zombie... As my mom once said about the Rolling Stones, which is hilarious, I never liked that hard rock.
Go ahead.
I'm not trying to turn this into TVTL. This is the show where we talk about the Amazon Prime show Patriot. But let me quickly mention that the other day when I was hanging out with my mom, I had to literally get the lyrics to the song Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones to prove to her that at no time does Mick Jagger say, "I can't get a girl pregnant" in the song. Because she has forever not liked the Rolling Stones and not liked them specifically because of that song where she claims Mick Jagger says, "I can't even get a girl pregnant." And I'm like, "Mom, that's not a lyric in that song." And I had to like literally show her the lyrics on my phone. And even then she was like, "I don't know what version you're looking at, but I'm pretty sure he says it in the song."
Could you ask her to play the song and just like stop it and pause it at the moment where he says it so we could examine what those lyrics are? Maybe it's like a magic eye thing where if we listen to it the right way, we'll see it. We'll hear it.
Okay, so back to the show Patriot, which we are here to talk about. A couple things that sort of occurred to me before the opening credits even kick in. I thought it was interesting that John identifies when he's playing that music in the bar when Saperstein, I think, first hears him.
Mm-hmm.
I've this time around caught the song he's singing is basically he's identifying with the people who have to build children's caskets.
Yeah.
And he's saying, "Try to keep it to a couple of drinks." And I'm like, man, this guy is like, you know, this is dark stuff that he's dealing with. And that's I'm sure he feels a certain affinity with people that have to do something that's very, very grim.
Yeah. Is that the song where he's just singing about how hard it is to sleep at night? And for example, like the people who make the caskets, or am I conflating two different songs in this?
Yeah. That he's is talking about trying to get a good night's sleep, which, and that's almost exactly 2 months after he was captured. So it's like, it literally appears that he was rolled up in the rug, put in the cage. They played American Pie for 2 months, and then they let him out, and he went directly to a open mic and started playing music about it.
In Amsterdam, where we know that that's where he's kind of have, where he tries to begin his healing by smoking weed, staring at birds, and singing literal folk songs.
Yeah. I have to say, I love, this is just classic Patriot. I love all of the conversation around Afternoon Spray.
Mm-hmm.
And how you know, no one talks about Afternoon Spray. And we'll see this, I'm not spoiling anything, but we'll see this coming up with The Full Breakfast. The show will take something that is a concept no one has really thought of, and then they will treat it like it's a thing everyone knows about. Mm-hmm. And I find it totally entertaining.
Yeah, breakfast breads is still, and also we start to see the emergence of Cold One in this episode too, which has become like something that Genevieve and I joke around the house. Will be like, Cold One. We try to say it in whatever that, it's not a Cockney accent, but whatever that, where is the bag man and his brother from? What Sands? What is the soccer team?
Jaywick Sands.
Jaywick. So he's got some sort of a Jaywick accent, I guess. And he says, he keeps on saying Cold One, Cold One. And he keeps saying that, and it became like an earworm for me.
I love that guy so much.
Me too.
He's like if DJ Khaled was talented. And like, and then, you know, because of course now I've seen the episode twice. The first time I watched it, I didn't exactly know what was going to happen. I guess I should have gotten wise when John pulls a guitar string off. But it's just like, I'm so sad for him because he's such a sweet guy. And by the way, I think objectively and measurably cooler than Cool Rick. No offense.
Interesting.
I know they're supposed to be the same person, but in terms of being the same person, I think he's cooler than Cool Rick. I don't know why. Maybe it's the accent.
Maybe. I'm not arguing with you. I'm not arguing the point. I'm just surprised to hear it. I guess I would withhold judgment myself because I don't think we see as much of him.
Sure.
I mean, I guess from an outward point of view, if you were going to pass one of these people on a sidewalk, you wouldn't look at Cool Rick and think that guy's cool. You would pass this guy and you would think, oh, that looks like a cool guy. He kind of looks like a tough, cool guy.
I mean, if I was going to hang out, if I was going to have a Cold One on a boat where hopefully my brother wasn't being garroted with guitar strings, if I was going to hang out for an afternoon with someone, I would much rather it was I was that guy's brother, the big Jaywick Sands fan, rather than Cool Rick.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, because the whole premise is that, I mean, that's one of the things too. I just said that I love how they sort of treat Afternoon Spray like it's a thing. You know, it's just that Afternoon Spray. It's not the night. It's not the morning. They also go with this premise that sort of like everything that everybody, things don't maybe rhyme, but they sound the same. Or there's a famous phrase like history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. This idea that of course the bagman will have a brother who's like Rick. I mean, that's basically what Tom Tavner is saying. Go find his cool Rick. He's going to have one. And I'm like, is he? I don't know if I buy that premise, but okay, I guess we're going with that.
Yes, this for me, and you know, the first time I watched this episode, there were still so many things I didn't know, and I was so confused. And so watching this particular episode a second time, it makes so much more sense to me what they're saying and what the story is. And they lay it all out. They're saying this guy, this bag man, must live a parallel life to you, so therefore we can assume he's going to do certain things.
Has a doofy brother.
And he must have a doofy brother who's here because everything is fucked up, as they say. But you know what? Like, for me, rewatching this, I'm like, this is where you know, like, there are magical forces, sort of, in this show, or magical thinking, or like let's even stop nitpicking on some of the things. Like, well, does that add up? Because here you're like, okay, they're inventing a universe here. They're creating a universe where this thing that you could never count on this in real life. It makes no sense in the real world, but this is the universe they're creating here. So now you're like, oh, okay, we're just going to follow your rules, show, which I like.
Right. Yeah, I'm in for it. And I rarely do that with shows. I'm far too attached to what I think of as reality, and when things get magical or mystical or unexplained, I usually check out. But I'm committed to this show, and I'm happy to live in their universe where it's a given that the bagman, who's having this kind of parallel experience to John and is kind of miserable on the boat, and the brother's like, just have one cold one, like one beer, like he's I totally buy it as a thing in the universe of this show.
And can I just jump in and say now that I had a better understanding of what was going on, like I remember that, I mean, we're kind of all over the place. So if you don't mind me just jumping ahead, we've acknowledged the fact that John is going to kill the bagman. He's going to choke him with this guitar string on the ferry. Now that I had a fuller understanding of what's going on and the parallels between the two families, the killing of the bagman hit me on an emotional level so much more than the first time. I remember being very shocked. It's you know, quietly violent, as a lot of the John scenes are when they get violent. There's a quietness about them and a starkness, and I remember being shocked by it. But this time, now that they've built up this dynamic that, like, oh, well, you got this guy, I can't remember his name, the cool Rick equivalent, the bagman's brother. And now that you realize, oh, these guys are stand-ins or mirrors of John and Edward and or cool Rick or whatever, and you start to understand the relationship and the love that is probably there as well, that made me really sad to see him die. You know, the guy that is on the opposite side of our heroes.
I'm not even as sad for the bagman, for the guy who gets strangled. I'm so sad for his brother.
Yeah.
When he walks back with those two beers, you know, and he's just so confused, and he's just like, your heart breaks for him because he was, you know, I don't need to explain it to the viewers. They understand it. But it's just like a very, you know, that was a really wrenching scene to watch because of just thinking about how bereft the brother is going to be.
Yeah.
Another great moment in Leslie Claret. Let's close things that close.
Just let's keep things shipshape. Like, is that what he says too?
I just noted that he's like, you know, he's obviously he's trying to be sober. He's upset because the mini bar fridge has swung open the door and he can see alcohol, and it's very tempting for him. And he calls down, and it's like, you know, just some poor sap at the front desk, has nothing to do with what's going on in the room. And he's saying, let's close things that close. It's like this weird Leslie way of speaking that I find very entertaining, and I love it. It's overly formal in a certain way.
Let me play this scene. So we see him, the scene opens. He's staring what looks like directly at the camera. You don't know what the problem is. He's wearing his Yale
Did
sweatshirt.
Did he go to Yale?
I assume there's something I find funny about him just wearing that Yale, that classic Yale sweatshirt. And then you realize, oh, he's staring at a refrigerator full of booze, which represents temptation. He slowly picks up the phone.
Reception.
Housekeeping.
Un instant.
Service chambre.
Is this housekeeping?
Yes, how may I help you?
I'm in the Electress of Saxony room. Let's not leave the room fridge open in the future here.
I am sorry?
My fridge. Let's get ship shape. Let's close the things that close, okay?
So the fridge was left open?
Yes.
I'll make a note of it.
I'd appreciate it. I look forward to better service.
That line really stuck with me too. Like, he's so upset and he's dressing them down, yet he's doing it in this really polite but direct way. Like, the language he uses is kind of polite. I look forward to better service. I like made a note because I am somebody who likes to gripe to customer service people.
If he called it a polite fridge, I would know we were really onto some parallels with your life. Again, if you are only a McMillan man listener, go listen to TBTL, and that joke will go. Listen to 3,000 episodes of our other show, somewhere. And that joke will be buried in there somewhere. Also, I didn't realize this, but I guess, does John speak French? Because he speaks to Agathe's daughter in French, or he seems to at least understand what she's saying, and he speaks a little French to her.
Yeah, he must, and that kind of makes sense for me. I remember watching this the first time and thinking, oh, will he know it or not? And then when he did, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. International spy, you must know some languages. Or you better.
Right. And actually, French is the default setting in a number of, like, in Brussels, places like that. I think that he's, you know, he's Luxembourg, I believe. Oh, boy, I'm going to regret that. if that's not right. But I think that French is quite literally the lingua franca in a lot of those places, mm-hmm. and so it would make sense that he kind of has picked it up. So he talks to Agathe's kid. He's in Agathe's house because he's trying to get that stupid CD, right?
That's what he's trying to do. Okay, so
I assume
that
so,
makes
right?
sense.
That's what he's trying, because he's started the episode. I guess the episode started actually with him in the rug, but. Agathe has found him lying on the street, but unless I'm misremembering, we don't get a huge explanation on that, right? Because he lies down on the street to try to get Agathe's attention, but he's not successful in getting the CD. So
he faints at the end of the last one, right? Doesn't
right.
this pick up to get her attention? Is that what you said? Did I misunderstand what you were saying?
I thought he was trying to get her attention. Oh, you think, you know what? This is so interesting. I'm not saying you're wrong. I think I read the end of last episode, after he's been carrying that dude around in the backpack mm-hmm. forever. I think I thought, and I think you're actually right. It makes so much more sense. In my mind, he collapsed to get her attention to try to get the CD back from her. But he probably just collapsed from exhaustion. That's a much more logical scenario.
I think so, yeah, because also we now know that him walking through that crowd of people hopping had a real emotional toll on him. He thought he was hallucinating it. We find out in this episode he confesses that he's seeing things, and then his dad explains to him that, no, there is some hopping tradition in this city. So I think that, I mean, at the end of that just excruciating episode where he went through so much physical and emotional kind of – I don't know, stress, and I think he just collapses. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, that would make more sense, because it was a weird strategy for trying to get the CD back, if that's what he was doing, which is what I was thinking. So basically, I think he's trying to get this CD out of her house. That's why he goes into the house, and that's when the kid sees him, and I guess he sees himself as a murderer, right? He identifies as a murderer, but he does not kill kids.
Yeah, it's funny how he doesn't lie about that, right? A little kid says to him, are you a murderer? Keeping in mind, she just learned what murder is a few episodes ago, this cute little girl. So she says, are you a murderer? And he says, yes. And, you know, I forgot that he says yes to that, and it kind of shocked me anew hearing him. It's like, I don't know, man. If permission to jump all over the place, it's hard to get inside of John's head, because sometimes we really see the emotional toll his actions take. And it's not just strangling a dude on a ferry. It's also when he messes with people's emotions, when he has to blow an air horn into a guy's ear just to cause, trigger PTSD. Like, that hurts him almost as much as killing somebody hurts him. Yet he didn't – well, I guess maybe – maybe he comes around at first when he's sort of psychologically torturing Steven Chu, right? Isn't that his last name? Mm-hmm. That character, Steven Chu, when he's trying to get the helmet off of him. He's trying to get Steven to take his own helmet off by messing with him. He's suffering from brain damage, of course.
Yeah. Which is interesting to me. I'll let you finish, and then I'll throw in something on that.
Okay. So anyway, just a quick reminder, if you haven't seen the episode in a while, for some reason, he's trying to steal the special helmet that the brain damaged Steven Chu has to wear for several hours a day. And so he starts saying, hey, man, I heard you've been bragging about how you can comb your own hair, and everybody says you're a liar, and I came up here to show them that you're not a liar. And so he finally convinces Steven, who he's convinced his own name is Eugene somehow, to take off his helmet.
He's convinced Steven that his name is not John.
Oh, right, which is especially important, right?
Just to keep screwing with his poor little brain.
And probably so that things can't get traced back to John. If he says some guy named Ted came into my room, I think he uses the word or the name Ted. But anyway, he didn't seem as tortured in messing with Steven. I feel like he actually has a bit of real animosity towards Steven. I could be wrong about that, though. I'm just judging by kind of facial expression. And later on when we see him in the elevator holding the helmet, I guess he does look a little remorseful. But it's funny how it seems like he has less problems fucking with this kid who's like super innocent and whom he caused the brain damage of. He tried to kill him.
Yeah, because I was trying to create this kind of consistent, I don't know, operating system in John's brain, which was, if he's strangling the bag man who's part of this world of subterfuge and moving money and trying to get, nuclear weapons or something, I don't think he feels a ton of regret about killing that guy. It's like that guy's playing the game. It's like you don't feel bad about tackling. You're playing football and you're tackling somebody who's trying to run the ball. Like, they're all in on it. You don't run into the stands, though, and tackle someone because they're not playing in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I feel like when he does the horns, he looks like he's really dreading it. I think that has to do with his kind of PTSD and him being emotionally fragile himself. But the Steven thing is weird to me because it doesn't fit into that pattern, because poor Steven has done absolutely nothing wrong. He is, as you said, he's the way he is because of something John did. And then John, you know, doesn't seem to have any compunction about messing with him, which is weird.
Yes. And we don't know yet why he was stealing the helmet, right?
Well, there was something about, I mean, there was a Gil wanted to put John on a different account, or like John had done so well in that presentation that in the elevator he's saying, hey, let's put him on this thing. And I think that Leslie is saying, well, that's Stevens or whatever. And I don't know if he's trying to seal the deal with that. I don't know if he's trying to make it more or less likely that he has to take on that other account. I don't really understand the premise of why he's stealing Stevens' helmet, but I'm just filing it under generally fucking with him so that he does not advance in the company and take John's spot on the travel team, and also so that he does not figure out that John's the one who pushed him into traffic.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I figured – and yeah, I'm embarrassed. I've watched this series already, and I just can't remember. I feel like there's a physicality with that helmet. I feel like he needs that helmet. I feel like it's not just messing with his head. And I thought it might have something to do with the guy who's taped up, the Brazilian guy that he's got all taped up, but that it doesn't come to fruition there. And it is funny, like when John's in the elevator and he learns that he's going to have to give another presentation, he doesn't look like he wants to. It's like, you're right. There's like, in a certain way, maybe that makes him more valuable, so he stays on the travel team, which is really important. But on the other hand, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just, that means he has to memorize another hour of gibberish.
Yeah. Of Sprat Flange or whatever the hell. Ichabod is now kind of becoming. I love that freaking weird ass zip up sweatshirt they have Ichabod in. I mean, the zipper goes
all the way around the hood.
I know. It's so weird. I've actually seen those. I don't know in what universe you would need that particular design, but I have seen that. I've seen that style of shirt in the wild, if you can believe it.
So funny.
It's weird, and of course they're doing it intentionally, but I mean, he is so weird looking in that elevator in that outfit. He is leaning so hard into his Ichabodness, and yet he is so put off by the idea that people think his last name Ichabod is surprising.
I know it's most of the humor from the scene comes through the visuals, but if you don't mind, it's not long. So much of this episode happens in elevators. I love the elevator bits. And, I'm not saying we're not going to see more insides of elevators in later episodes, but I like that each episode kind of has a theme like this. Like, they're going to do a lot of humor in elevators in this episode. And in this one, Ichabod comes in just looking ridiculously like Ichabod Crane.
John, why'd you ask if my last name Ichabod was the nickname?
I didn't.
Yes, you did, John. You mentioned that. You said, I quote, hey, what's your last name, Peter, anyway? I said Ichabod. You said, I thought that was the nickname. Why did you think that?
Just no reason.
Is it because I look like I live in an enchanted forest, in a grim fairy tale, wearing a cloak or some such?
No. Or, yeah, I guess. Honestly, Peter, but not in a bad way.
And then somebody else gets on the elevator. Oh, my God. This was an especially funny episode, I think. The last episode really takes a lot out of you as a viewer. He's just like, John is going through so much. And this episode, actually, by the way, very high smile count for John
in
this episode.
Yes, I've got smile alert.
Yes.
Dad hug. My note says... by the way, Julian Richings is the actor who plays Peter Ichabod, and I'm just looking up. He's a English-born Canadian actor, and he played Death on the show Supernatural, which my friend Misha plays character. One of the he plays an angel on that show. I bet you Misha knows this guy. I should ask him I don't know what. How is Julian Richings to be around, and is he super weird?
Let's get Ichabod probably on not. The show, yeah.
We could. I think it would be within our abilities. If we maybe in season two, or I don't know, if at some point we start to do interviews, I think we could. I bet you we could get Julian on. He lives in Toronto, apparently. We can get him on the phone, maybe. So this was a well, let's try. I'll just try to keep this going chronologically. So there's this very stressful elevator scene where you've got the Barros brothers and Rob Saperstein and Ichabod and John, and it's just like there were two scenes where I have to say, like the drunk scene where John and Rob are like kind of just running wild in the streets and like starting fights or maybe ending fights and then running upstairs. That is a perfect. That perfectly captures the feeling of being drunk in a city when you're having fun and you're having an adventure. Like, they nail that. I've been on many drunk adventures in cities, and like I just thought that tonally was really good. And then as a person who is in my life been fairly sketchy at times, I've never been in something like that elevator scene, but I can feel the tension of like, these people are not supposed to be meeting right now.
Yes.
Like, that is a bad feeling, and they do a really good job of setting up that dynamic.
And going back to John Smiles, which we're obsessed with because he's so withholding, or the show is so withholding of Smiles.
Well, yeah, I don't know if he's withholding. I think he's incapable because of his trauma.
But we see a lot of him in the flashbacks because, first of all, we see him smiling when he's stoned. Like, he's totally self-medicating with the marijuana. We see him do some legit smiles out there while he's recovering in the flashbacks. When he reunites with Rob, even though it is a very stressful scene on that elevator and Rob is about to blow his cover, I still think John can't help but to break into that big, dumb smile because he's truly has love for Rob. And that's like part of the tragedy of the John character. What makes the show so good is the dynamics of like John is just all heart, but he's being forced to be a killer.
And Rob's arguably the McMillan people know John from a different world, but Rob is like one of the only people who is there's nothing about his existence and his relationship with John that's related to all of this dark shit that John has to do. This is only happiness. And there's actually a cute moment where when John wakes up, when he crashes out, like after their night of playing music and learning afternoon spray and getting drunk and all that, there's this moment where John wakes up. They're both basically pass out drunk. John wakes up and he goes, Rob, are you still here? And like Rob is still there. And I thought, oh, that's like a guy who really needs human connection, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think so you're right. I think that there's a really strong bond there, even though Rob is kind of a mess. But so that elevator seat is like extremely stressful. Then we get to the Barros brothers, this great scene where Dennis is translating from the other room. Classic Dennis move where he's like, he gets the room next to John. He asked for it. By the way, the rooms of the hotel are almost characters. You know, they intentionally are constantly, and I can't say them off the top of my head, but they're constant. I mean, when Leslie calls down, he says what room he's in. Everyone's saying, what's it called? The King Oscar or something?
Yeah, I think so.
Everyone's talking about the King Oscar. It's where we stay. It's good. And like everyone's staying there. Everyone's staying in these like fun, like, oddly named rooms, which are referenced a lot to each other. It's just kind of the hotel seems to loom. And you said a lot of the shots are in elevators. Mm-hmm. The hotel looms large in this. So you got that scene where they're trying to negotiate with the Barros brothers. And Dennis is – to be honest with you, Dennis's translation was better than I expected. Like, he did throw in some F-words. He tried to put a little Dennis stank on it. Yeah, but he is generally – I was expecting – Dennis is such a nincompoop. I was expecting him to be like that ad that's running right now where the guy says, I speak a little Danish or whatever it is, and then he's totally mistranslating in the business meeting.
Oh, yeah. That's a really funny commercial.
I was expecting that. And no, Dennis actually does speak Portuguese and actually is more or less translating the message of what they're saying.
Yes. I apologize, but this goes again, moving way forward to a scene, but still like kind of this dynamic that Dennis can hear what's going on in John's room comes up again later. He even says like, oh yeah, I can translate through the door because I made sure that our rooms are next to each other. And John kind of grins a little bit at that. We know that, you know, Dennis just wants to be best friends with John, but John also kind of is loving Dennis the same way that he kind of loves his brother, I think, and is seeing him as a real ally. So he kind of gets a kick out of that and appreciates it. And then later on, when his dad shows up in Luxembourg to surprise him, and you, like you said, we get another smile there when they hug in the hallway. And then later on, this is, again, one of my – this is a great laugh line in the episode. We forget that Dennis is in the other room and probably listening to everything they're saying. And Tom is saying to John, we got to go out. We got to have a good time. And then Edward says, can I come with you? And he says, well, it wouldn't be a good time if you didn't come with us, which is such a really sweet thing to say. And then you hear the muffled voice of Dennis coming from the other room. Can I come too? It's so
this
sweet.
This is I have to say, you know, I'm a noted anti-Tom Tavner, whatever the opposite of a stan is. I do not stand Tom Tavner. Mm-hmm. I do not stand him. Maybe that's what it is. You just add a D, and it means you don't like the person. I had a moment where I was thinking, okay, maybe he's winning me over. And it's the moment when John is more or less apologizing for being on the CD cover.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little backstory. I think Tom says something like, there's no pictures of you since you were 19 or something, which is also just like, you know, this is a weird comparison to make, but people who are marginalized in our current culture talk about being disappeared, you know, or made invisible. And this is the thing where, like, I didn't even think about the one of the, you know, I don't see John going to a glamour shots shoot, even if he was just into piping, but he can't even have a picture taken of him for his whole adult life. I mean, that sucks. Like, you know, like that's the kind of level of secrecy and subterfuge. So then,
by the way, who took that picture? That's I mean, I think the show purposely doesn't address that because I think it's just a flight of fancy sort of. We see early on Rob and John like kind of practice posing for the picture, doing that Simon and Garfunkel parody album cover look, looking over their shoulders. But they specifically say, let's practice it. So we know that there's nobody behind them with a camera. When you look at the actual album cover, whenever it does get taken, it's kind of almost it's taken in a way that it almost seems like somebody would have to be on a ladder. It's kind of above them a little bit. Am I not right about
that? I'm not saying you're wrong. My read on things was that moment on the street where they turn around is the moment the picture's actually taken. But I don't know who would be taking the photo, and maybe you're right. Maybe the actual CD cover is from a higher angle. I had kind of imagined somehow that photo ended up happening out on that street.
Well, they're dressed in the right – they're definitely dressed in the right clothes for it to be the actual moment, but I swear the dialogue – can we actually just listen to this because why not? What else do we have to do? I'm just getting there to it now, but I think he says something like, well, let's practice it. Okay, let's practice
it. They definitely practice it. My sense was that I just thought that then after they practice it, then it really happens.
I
can't say that for a fact.
Then, well, I'll just play it anyway. I don't know if we really
need
to.
Yeah, play it.
Let's
hear it.
Wistfully back at the camera. You want to practice?
You think we need to practice that?
Yeah, I think we need to practice. It's our album cover. We need to do it right.
Okay,
1, 2, 3.
They look over, and then the theme song begins. And then little boys dance next to their motorcycles, which gets me.
I want to know if we ever get Stephen Conrad on the show. I want to know what the casting process was like for the kids in the opening credits.
Good question.
Like, because I want to know, who are those kids? Did they know how to ride motorbikes? How long did it take them to do that? To learn how to do that thing with the bikes, the jig, the shooting of the gun, the whole thing. Are they really brothers? Do they live in Texas? I want to know about the kids in the credits.
Yes.
That's for my spin-off show, McMillan Kids, where it's a whole show about the young Tavner boys. But what I was going to say is, I find, you know, Tom Tavner has this moment of just absolute, just lovely fathering. Is that a thing? Where he says to John, you know, basically, I effed this entire thing up. I gave the money to the wrong person. All you did was, you were just in a photo. And I was like, go, Tom. Good job. And then later he's like, go kill him.
Yeah, I know. I knew that.
Like, huh? And I'm like, easy for you to say, jerk.
Yeah, that's where he really just says, you have to kill him. And he just, you know, and I was thought of you immediately because I was like, yeah, here he is pushing John to the edge of his sanity again by forcing him to do these things. My favorite part during that conversation John has just explained to him the concept of afternoon spray, which is totally ridiculous.
Yes.
And then a few minutes later in the conversation, he's like, hey, man, I've effed up too, man. I've made huge mistakes, and I wasn't even in this afternoon splash.
I love it. Let's see. I have some notes here that now I'm trying to remember exactly the context for them. Do we want to talk about the – is he – have we decided, is he the physicist? Is the wife – the woman who wants to watch the Disney programming, is she the wife of the physicist?
Or the bag man?
I don't think she's... Oh, it never even occurred to me she was potentially the bag man's wife. I assume she was the physicist's wife.
I think so, too. I know that I had the question.
Somebody called Omi Shade?
I had that question, too. I was like, oh, wait, is she the wife of the bag man or the physicist? I think the physicist.
Yeah. Anything about her jump out at you? That scene was kind of interesting. This again, because I've seen the show, I know a little bit more about what's going to happen to her eventually. But I thought it was interesting, you know, this sort of cultural thing of basically like her wanting to watch a Disney movie, and but her wanting it to be on in the room. I guess maybe because she doesn't want to see anything else, she doesn't want to be corrupted by anything else.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it as well. And again, like this is the show's calling card is that they give everybody layers, right, and texture, mm-hmm. and not just and even this person who's been, you know, regarded as a pretty kind of shadowy figure because she's draped head to toe in traditional garb, right, which to the Western eye can seem sort of like it can seem off-putting to us without being xenophobic about it. It's not a look that we're used to around here.
We're not familiar with.
Yeah, and so when you're looking at somebody who all you can see is their eyes, it gives you a feeling. And then to sort of now we're starting to see that, okay, now her character is starting to open up, is starting to bloom a little bit as far as our perspective, and we're getting to see her complexities. And so, yeah, she must be – my interpretation of it, I don't know if I'm right, but is that, okay, she is in the United States, and she must be overwhelmed a little bit with the curiosity of the West. I'm sorry, I said she's in the United States. She's clearly not in the United States, but she's in a Western country and has access yep. to the American culture. And so she wants to taste a little bit of it, but she's trying to not get pulled in too deep. So yeah, that's why she wants it turned on in her room. I also like the way this scene made me think that I need to ask for more things, especially like at hotels, because he didn't even blink an eye. He's like, yeah, customer's always right. We'll make sure that the what is the movie she wants to watch? I can't remember. It's about the little girl.
I think it's a – does she name it specifically? I just remember it being a Disney.
Yeah.
Maybe she had a specific Disney movie she wanted to watch.
Definitely, because remember she makes him list them, and then he has to describe them.
Oh.
One of them is Wreck-It Ralph. One of them is
right.
Something 3,
yeah.
And I can't remember.
I thought it was strange that she said, let's turn things on that turn on.
Yeah,
that was a weird direction to the hotel. You're right, though. Like, the hotel staff is pretty much like, hey, whatever you need, I'll talk to somebody about that refrigerator door being open, crazy
yep.
guy. And also, absolutely, we'll go in there and turn on, you know, Mulan or whatever
yeah.
Disney programming you were interested in watching.
I'm getting very close. Your Disney choices, according to the subtitles, would be, why don't I just turn it up?
Beverly Hills Chihuahua 3.
Beverly Hills
Tingled
Chihuahua
and
3. Tangled, that's the one.
Right.
And what are they concerning?
Well, Beverly Hills Chihuahua, that's probably about dogs. Tangled is about a young woman on an adventure, it looks like, from the trailer. And I don't know for this other one.
And again, great acting, great directing. We only see a close-up of her face, but again, all we see are her eyes kind of reacting yeah. to the titles. And when he says, Chihuahua, that one must be about dogs, she looks confused. Like, why would there be a movie about dogs?
That guy, by the way, that front desk guy actually is in a lot of these episodes because he's the guy that tells Saperstein that John has been there. He's he's sort of the front desk guy that most of the time when people are coming into this King Oscar, they're talking to him.
And I just love hotel tropes, sort of, or I don't know if trope is the right mm-hmm. word, but on the airplane recently, I watched, what's the Wes Anderson one? Shoot.
That one.
It's got hotel in the title, and I can't think of the name of it.
Hotel Transylvania 3.
Exactly, which I watch right after Wreck-It Ralph. But anyway, I love things that take place. There's a – Well, you know me, even in real life, I'm kind of obsessed with hotels.
Yeah, your dream would be to run a hotel, right?
And there's
like
something,
a small one.
And there's something magical about the way hotels like this are portrayed in movies, you know? I even think of Four Rooms, which I probably doesn't hold up, but I loved that in the 90s.
The Grand Budapest.
Grand Budapest Hotel,
we were
thank
thinking
you.
Thinking of.
Yes.
There's also this moment where liar is written on the door.
Mm-hmm.
That's Steven, right?
No.
Oh.
Do we want to give it away to the people who are watching with us? Because, I mean, I know who it is. The reveal comes maybe next episode or two episodes ago.
Well, don't reveal it because I'm one of them. I apparently have some kind of amnesia. I assumed. It's funny. I've watched it and I don't remember it. I thought that that was maybe Steven having a moment of like full lucidity or something. But it's somebody else. I guess we'll find out next episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I know who it is. Unless, okay. Boy, this would be another one where if I'm wrong about this, it becomes a big part of the plot that somebody really has it in for John, somebody whom we have met, but I won't spoil it for you. But
yeah. Oh, of course. Now I remember.
Right.
It is. But I'll let the people that are watching episode by episode experience it.
But
for the first time,
can I say this? You know, speaking of me saying stupid shit, I wanted to start this show by saying this. It's been driving me crazy. I think it's okay to say this now. We recorded Macmillan Men number 3 and number 4 on the same day, but then released them a week apart. But I made I said something that was categorically untrue in episode 3. I've been hearing from a lot of people. Both
is that why they wrote liar on the door?
Yeah.
Is that about you?
That's right. I will say the first person who gave me this piece of feedback was Genevieve, my wonderful partner Genevieve, who is apparently a P1 for Macmillan Men, which just makes me feel very happy. Yeah. But I made the argument that Leslie was the founder of the Macmillan Company. That is not true.
Oh.
He started a piping company. He did not
thought.
Yes. No. You were right. You were. Let's give you a double bell. I apologize
Thank
for
you.
Arguing
double
otherwise.
Great.
There's just like a lot of evidence around it kind of indicating that that is not the case. And then specifically listener Sean said he didn't start Macmillan. He started one of the other companies competing for the Denon Project, which he mentioned specifically in season 2 when he gives his big speech. So not just circumstance. Evidence, but actual evidence that I was totally wrong. And the more I thought about it, I was like, oh yeah, that can't. Why would it be called Macmillan? Why wouldn't it be called Leslie and the Boys?
Hey, speak.
Which is what I would name.
No, that's the piping company I would go with. For all of your piping needs, call Leslie and the Boys. I could see it having like a hyper local ad, like Favinger Plumbing here in Bellingham, where I live. Their logo is. Or their sort of claim to fame is that the owner of the company, he drives a white VW Bug, and he's always driving it in the commercials. I could see Leslie and the Boys having just a hilariously local. Stop freaking. Call Leslie and the Boys.
I couldn't think of his last name, so that's why I went with it. It's Leslie Claret, right? Claret?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As our friend Steve Newman, a.k.a. the Stewbot, is called on Twitter currently, and this will probably change by the time this gets out, Leslie Claret Appreciator.
Right. Well, I'm glad I could claret things up.
Heyo. Man, that could be a possible show title for this. Let's see. Speaking of listener feedback, I know that you had an email that had piqued your interest or you thought was worth reading. Should we just jump into that? Right here, right now.
Yeah.
Okay time.
This is about the music. Of course, music plays a huge role in the show. We got to hear Afternoon Spray at the beginning of this episode, or Afternoon Splash. I wasn't even in an Afternoon Splash when I made my decision.
Am I the only person that when I see Afternoon Spray, I think of Afternoon Delight, and I almost want to say, Afternoon Spray, and do that like little note run that they do for Afternoon Delight?
When I was first watching this, I assumed that was a playoff of that in some way, but I don't know that it is because it's not the right genre, right? Like
it
I definitely
isn't. I
think the same thing, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're playing on something that I'm not getting there or if it's just a coincidence. But pardon me, I'm doing that John Mulaney thing where I'm trying not to burp. Okay, so this email came in about the debate. that John is getting into with somebody named Greg 12 on a message board somewhere. We heard about this in the last episode. And he says that he's arguing with some kid named Greg 12 over the song Poncho and Lefty, which is a Townes Van Zandt song. And but Willie Nelson does a version of it. And there's a little bit more depth to it. I got this email from several people, but I really like the way that Tony in Austin lays this out. He says in episode 4...
Austin seems like the right place to be checking in.
Yes.
Not that Townes Van Zandt was necessarily from Austin, but like this is regionally a person who's going to know about this kind of music in my mind.
Right. Well, he is from Texas, right? I think that comes up in this email. So I think so. Fellow McMillan man here, just a couple of thoughts on the music in the first 4 episodes. In episode 4, the debate over Poncho and Lefty is not an uncommon one in the folk country world. Traditionalists maintain that Townes Van Zandt, who wrote the song, did it best, and that Willie and Merle Haggard's cover, while indisputably more popular from a sales standpoint and an audience standpoint, was too polished, and the 80s production distracted from its story. In his debate with Greg 12, John takes up the traditional argument that Willie ruined it. Don't fight with Willie. I'm not fighting with Willie. It may be simply
with Greg 12.
It may be simply coincidental, but in episode number 1, the song that John and Tom play together on their guitars is also a Townes Van Zandt song, If I Needed You. There may be a little father-son symbology in these lyrics. If I needed you, would you come to me? Would you come to me and ease my pain? You can imagine that the next lines might be, if I needed you, would you hold my bike, or would you let me go and watch me crash? Yeah. I don't know if there...
Or would you make me go and kill a guy?
Right. I don't know if there are any other Townes Van Zandt songs in the rest of the series, but I'll be listening for them. It may be as simple as Stephen Conrad wanting to show his Texas roots bona fides, but I thought it was at least marginally interesting. So that's,
can I play a little bit of the... I don't know if this is... This looks like a live version, but it also has 5 million views, so maybe this is the most popular. Can I play a little bit of the Townes Van Zandt version? Yeah. Just because, why not? Sorry, this is from YouTube, so the audio quality is probably crummy.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron, and your breath's as hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only son, but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye. You sank into your dreams.
Look, I honestly don't even know if I've heard the Willie Nelson Merle Haggard one, but I'm willing to say this is the better version.
Now, is this the actual recorded? Did I hear somebody coughing in that, or is this an interesting
Yeah,
line?
This is live.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if this is clearly not the whatever one's put out on the radio, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it also has, like I said, it has 5 million views, and so I wondered if maybe it's a famous version of it. Mm. I don't know enough about Townes Van Zandt other than, and I mentioned this to another person who emailed in about, I can't remember if it was related to McMillan Men or not, but that movie Blaze, which is a biopic about Blaze Foley, it features a person portraying Townes Van Zandt, and it's incredible. Mm. The movie's incredible, and that guy's performance. I think everybody's performance in that movie is incredible. Again, I talked about it on TBTL. If you're a guy of a certain age who's wired the way I am, don't see the movie with your wife and daughter because you may just sob the entire film, which is what I did. I'm trying to remember. It's so much of this series I've forgotten, sadly, but that's why it's actually been really fun to rewatch it, pick up some new things. Do we meet Greg 12?
I don't think we ever meet Greg 12.
I kept waiting for somebody to be Greg 12, like Rob to be Greg 12. But that's, you know, one of those things that's probably like a little too, I don't know, maybe too expected in a way or something. Like maybe that's the Stephen Conrad doesn't want to. By the way, speaking of, sorry, real quick digression on Stephen Conrad, I've been also really getting into, I've been trying to hold off on watching too much of Perpetual Grace Limited, his other show, because I don't want to confuse everybody in my mind. And but there's the song for Perpetual Grace Limited, the theme song for season 1 anyway, which is maybe the only one they're on, is awesome. I love it. And I looked up who it was. It's like Stephen Conrad's band.
Oh, really? Is Jeremy Renner in there?
Happy Ren's Day. No, but I liked it. So I guess my point is that Stephen Conrad's obviously a very musical person. Music is obviously huge to him. As I said incorrectly on the first episode, but has since been corrected, the Vashti Bunyan song for this first season is just the last song I would ever expect a show like this to have. Well, a show that is about CIA operatives to have, and yet it somehow just totally works for the show. I don't know if that's just because it's what I associate with the program, but I do love the use of music on the show.
I just looked this up just really quickly. I haven't seen any Perpetual Grace Limited, but so it's performed and it's written by and performed by Stephen Conrad, Bobby Bear Jr., Jim Becker, Brad Jones. They go by the Jones Sisters.
Yeah.
I love it.
Do you want to hear that? Is that weird? Would that be super weird?
I have maybe, it here, you know, I think.
Yeah, just play it for sure. Now, here's the thing. There's a lot of visuals associated. The opening of that show is an astronaut in space, because that's a kind of a plot point in that show.
Okay.
So I think you might kind of want to see the visual, but just imagine an astronaut in space as this song is playing. Start talking, because it's probably some kind of a like copyright violation if we play the whole song. Yeah, but I'll just tell you that, in my opinion, that song with it's basically filming a spacewalk. Mm-hmm. Like the combination of that song behind the images of someone doing a spacewalk, it really works for me. And I just also love, I mean, obviously, season one of this show is the Vashti Bunyan song, and then the second season, I don't think I'm spoiling anything. Well, would I be spoiling if I mention it's, let's just say, a totally different kind of song. Mm-hmm. And then you got this one that they wrote for Perpetual Grace Limited. I just like the range.
Yes, and also, like, I don't know anything about Perpetual Grace, the show, or the concept, but if I were to hear that song, I wouldn't guess that that is accompanying, or that's something that's essentially written for a spacewalk. You know what I mean? You would think,
yes,
more,
right.
More theremin, more David Bowie, yes, influence, like something
totally
spacey, not this, like, roots, yeah, music. But he makes,
yeah,
that work.
Nice.
He just, he always, I mean, again, I haven't seen those credits, but like that is the type of thing that you see in Patriot. He just takes things that seem like they don't fit together and makes them work, like some sort of weird spy show written like a poet.
But I wonder about that a little bit. Like, is it, we should just try to get him on the show at some point, because I have a lot of questions for him. I got a lot of questions for you, Conrad. Hey, Birdbath, will you get Conrad on the show for us, please?
Yeah. Not enough Birdbath, by the way. I'm not just sucking up.
No, we'll
Birdbath.
Get there.
Yeah.
We'll get. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can never have too much Birdbath, yeah, on the show, as far as I'm concerned. But I wonder if Stephen Conrad, I mean, there's so much thought and care that has gone into this show. It's obvious. Nothing is haphazard. But I also wonder if sometimes he isn't just like, I love this song, and I'm just going with my gut here. Or like, did they test five other Vashti Bunyan songs? Did they test five other songs? Did they even test them? Did they play them for people? You know, because sometimes when there's a seemingly incongruous kind of thing of visual and audio, you can think, oh man, they must have done 5,000 versions of it and they found the right one. Or it might have just been like they just made an executive decision, and then once you see it a few times, it just makes sense to your brain.
Or you're driving into the studio one day and you pop that in, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, this could work. Like, I love stories.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know. I also
totally
love the fact that we keep on saying we should have Stephen Conrad on the show, yet so far I'm pretty sure 100% of the questions we have for him are about the 45-second opening credits, I think, which is actually though, I say that somewhat seriously, somewhat superficially, but I think it speaks to the depth of this show. Like, just those credits have so much going on without feeling overwhelming.
And, I mean, I don't know if this applies as much to shows on Amazon. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I mean, broadcast TV, we've talked about this a lot on our other show on TBTL, but broadcast TV has really done away with credits because they just don't trust anyone's attention span. Now, what they do with Patriot that's kind of genius is they do, you know, I don't know what the technical term for it is. I would say cold open, but that's like an SNL term. But they basically start the show, and then at some point when you kind of least – you forget that there are credits, mm-hmm. and you're just like – you're in as the viewer, and then all of a sudden it's like – then that music comes in and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, now we're going to watch the credits. But that's, I don't know. I mean, are they, is that, I wonder if that's unique. I'm trying to think of other shows that I watch on that are just on demand platforms. And if they, if those shows have more credits, cause they figure you picked, you know, you came there on purpose. And so they figure you can sit through the credits, like sitcoms and stuff. Nobody has like the Cheers theme anymore or something of that length. It's got to be like 5 seconds because they're worried everyone's going to start looking at their phone or something.
Yes, but I mean, I think there are some others. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but I know that I've had conversations with Genevieve about how, like, I'll watch this a million times and I'll never fast forward through the credits. What I like about the Patriot one is it just splits the different splits the difference perfectly because it's, you know, I'll bet you it's half the length of a full Cheers intro, right? But it has mm-hmm. so much more going on. Actually, I even like the Cheers intro. I think that that always kind of mesmerized
Absolutely.
Me as a kid. Like,
I wanted to, in the words of Tina Fey, go to there.
Yeah, yeah. And like the
and
weird
I was
parallels
able to,
between
for many years.
Yeah, but like the weird parallels. Like as a kid, I was always looking for one to one like references between the photos they were showing and what's going on mm-hmm. in the actual show. And I think I would still do that if I were to watch it today. Like I'm not, because they show one person who looks very much like George Wendt.
Yes. Look, by the guy who's raising his, yes. he's raising his drink.
Right.
He's
yes.
cheersing, right?
Exactly. But they're not all one-to-one. So
right. I had the exact same thought as a kid. I was like, is that George Wendt? I didn't
right.
know his name was George Wendt, but I was like, are these all people that are in the, where's the Rhea Perlman? Is there a tiny, tiny Rhea Perlman in there?
Right, right. And anyway, I just want to welcome everybody to Malone Men, the new podcast where we break down the intro of Cheers.
Love it. I would listen to that show. I would bank that show with you, my
yes.
friend. One last thing here that happens at towards the end of this episode is Timmons and Saperstein get they're allowed to basically go play this festival, and you know, because Afternoon Spray has gotten a little bit of moderate have they gotten to that part yet where I forget the exact terminology that he's using about the kind of radio play they're getting, but I remember it cracking me up when I heard
That's I can't remember what the I think I have it here if we want to do it, although this infuriated me a little bit because you don't call and get yourself invited to a folk festival that you're supposed to play that evening without checking with the other person who's in your duo.
Are you trying to let me know to not do that? Is that
just saying,
the point of this?
I would like to know before you book a Waffle House for a TBTL event.
Well, then this
event.
Makes me a Saperstein because Saperstein is so geeked.
That is true.
He's just like, we got a chance. And then you're kind of over there Timmonsing going like, although I don't think – well, I think the thing for Timmons is it's really a scheduling issue. He's got to kill someone at 2. I got to dispose of a body. My afternoon is just shot. I don't know if – no, I mean literally I'm being shot at
yeah.
this afternoon.
How long does
I
that take?
I don't know if
Four
I
minutes.
Can get out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Let's just listen to the scene where he tells him that okay. He's got to come to a folk festival that night.
Yeah. Well, not really, but you know what is cool? We're getting medium play on 3 independent radio stations in Central Europe.
I'll stop it there. That's what you wanted to hear, right?
That's a great needle drop. And
play.
By the way, that how that is not a TBTL drop.
That's
yet.
A good
I don't
point.
Know. We need to put that in the mix. I'd kill for medium play
in
several European
Central European markets.
Anyway, so they go out to the festival, and you know. Saperstein is vamping in a very funny way, by the way. I love that scene, too, before John gets there when Saperstein's trying to explain what the music is supposed to sound like.
Which, again, is silly because, like, this is folk music. Like, you can do these songs solo. You know that Rob has probably sat in his apartment and strummed these songs and sung them by himself, right? Like, you don't need the backup vocals on this song, but he's, like, stopping and saying, okay, imagine here a higher voice comes in. But I think he's just in his head too much about it, or he's just kind of a dingus.
Well, didn't he kind of, like, sort of hand the vocals of Afternoon Spray over to John a little bit? Because I felt like when he's trying to teach him the song, John singing it and playing it. This is back at the apartment years previous. So I kind of feel like he wrote Afternoon Spray, but then I think he kind of sees John as the person singing it.
But I'm talking about the song before Afternoon Spray, the Supercell song. He says this song is called Supercell, and he starts singing a song, and then he and then people are he's like, okay, now here another voice comes in, and be like, no, you would just do the voice. I mean, you would again. It's a joke. I'm not trying to trying to shit on
it. I love
it.
But I was very it's funny because like. I keep wanting John again. I've seen this. I haven't seen all, you know, both seasons, but I've seen the first season and into the second season of the show. And I know that John does not become an international folk sensation, but I keep thinking maybe he can this time I watch it. And I get excited for him when he shows up at this festival and there's a bunch of people and they kind of know Afternoon Spray because it's been getting medium play.
Right.
And like, I was like, all excited for him. And then, of course, he's, you know, you can't put that guy behind a mic without getting some.
Yeah.
Getting some real talk. And he, just as things are starting to, you think if it was a different kind of show, he plays Afternoon Spray and everyone's excited, but it's not. It's Patriot. And so he, of course, can't leave well enough alone and then just shifts into singing about shit that he's been actually dealing with.
Here we go.
Laying in your clearing, we're limb by limb. Built me in one morning with the leaves around your skin. I hear rain fall on the palm of the only hand that will hold mine. And I listen, yeah, I listen. I just lay there with her and listen. Drifting afternoon.
Do you think anyone's having this played as their first song at their wedding or as their walk down? Somebody out there somewhere, please do that. Please, not the whole part that he's about to sing, but someone have Afternoon Spray perform.
No, I want somebody to walk down the aisle to this, part here.
Okay.
My boss Leslie is like your grandfather that you like less than your other grandfather. Cause he's kind of a prick and he says things like keep your hair cut. But he just cares about things you should care about, like doing your work right and showing up on time, keeping your word and old world craftsmanship. But he's probably a better man. Your more casual grandpa, here's to old school.
Keeping an OS.
I think you're grandpa number one. And I just wanted to tell you that, and that I'll probably mess you up somehow anyway.
At this point, Rob is just like staring at him, and then John just kind of breaks down and walks off the stage, which is a very upsetting scene. Somehow this is almost more upsetting than the murder scene earlier.
Is it because in your mind he is having this great moment and it's just clear that he cannot stop himself?
Yeah, I think maybe that is part of it. I hadn't really thought about it too much. Maybe part of it is just kind of like, to me, there's nothing worse than bombing on stage. But no, things are starting to go right. We see John smile a lot. Listen, I'm not trying to give anything away, but the SPMs, or smiles per minute, are going to go into the negatives, especially in season two. It becomes, I love the show, but it becomes emotionally draining as it goes on. And maybe I'm misremembering it. Maybe there's more comedy nuggets in there than I'm remembering, but it really, the show takes on a feeling of, wow, how far are we going to keep digging into this morass? And this episode seems like one that has a lot of happiness. It happens at weird times and inconvenient times, but there is some happiness in this episode, and I'm wondering if this is the turning point. Like, and one of the things he should be happy about is he's getting medium radio play in several Central European countries, and somebody from the audience knows him well enough to yell, "We love you, Rob." So there's a certain amount of kind of acceptance and love there, and then he can't even get through it. And I think we've seen the peak happiness of John.
Yeah, interesting. So basically, savor the flavor, folks.
Yeah.
Enjoy them. Smoke them if you got them, because it's it'll be fascinating but dark from here on out. Anything else that you wanted to throw in about this show?
I guess just for the point of wrapping things up, we should say that it ends. John leaves the folk concert. He's walking alone through the streets of Luxembourg, and then he sees the bag yes. that all the money is in, laying in the middle of the street, and nobody's around. And then that's the end of the episode.
Yes. A good cliffhanger. My interest was piqued, even though I know who had the bag. Like, mm-hmm. But I was like, oh, my God, what's going to happen next? Mm-hmm. I was like, you remember. You watched this 6 months ago. Okay, fine. Time for bed.
But I'm still thanks for taking us all the way on that conversation. I'm also still looking forward to it, though. Brush your teeth. Oh, man, you got to get a new head for your Quip yeah. electric toothbrush.
That's right. Hey, are we doing ads on this show? Quip, get at us.
I can't remember. Oh, I was going to say, I'm really looking forward to the next episode, though, because this episode was a good example of me kind of just kind of plowing my way through it, even though I think I was lost on a lot of things the first time I watched this episode. This time, everything really clicked for me, and it made crystal sense to me. And mm-hmm. so I'm looking forward to next episode, because things do get complicated with the person who took the bag. Not yes. the bag man, but the bag man's bag man. So,
mm-hmm. Who bags the bag man's bag man?
Can that be the show title?
No one's ever asked. Yeah, sure. All right, I guess that's it then. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll be here next week. Make sure until then you keep things double great.
Living on the road, my friend, was gonna keep you free and clean. Now you wear your skin like iron and your breath's as hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye. Sank into your dreams. Poncho was a bandit, boys. His horse was fast as polished steel. Wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. But Poncho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. And nobody heard his dying words. But that's the way it goes. And all the federales say they could have had him in here.